funny how? I mean funny like I'm a clown, I amuse you? Like I'm a clown? 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 I'm a clown?
Rosebud.
Welcome to the Silver Screen video with Jonathan and Jacob. And off the bat, I'm going to go ahead and say, apologize if I sound a little weird this episode. I left my mic in back home, and I am currently in Ireland, so I'm using a different microphone setup. So I apologize if it sounds a little weird, but we'll get through it. We wanted to give you guys an episode. So anyway, Jonathan, Jacob. Jacob, how's it going? Has the weather gotten shittier in New York since you're moving more into the winter months?
Okay, don't act all casual, mister. I'm in Ireland for like a fucking month. Oh, how's the weather or whatever? You're in Ireland. You're like you're essentially like a quarter bog monster now?
I am starting to become more bog-like since I've been here.
What's that look like up close? Like is your skin turning to algae? Like what's happening there?
It's more of an algae potato mixture. Just the way the Irish like it.
right. Just moss covered potatoes and rocks.
Enough, I have eaten a lot of potatoes since we've been here. So
that's not odd at all. You're in Ireland.
Well, it's like I typically love potatoes anyway, but it's just funny now to eat them when they're not like, I genuinely love potatoes. I believe they are a highlight to a meal. You can do so much with them. And then you get over here and I feel like if I express my love of potatoes, I'm going to be viewed as like some asshole. Like, oh, fuck you. Right. It's like, no, I really do love potatoes. This is a genuine love. This is not a mockery of your potato country.
Well, just as an American, I mean, they're always going to look at you as some asshole. I mean,
that's true. I will tell you this. I have mastered driving on a different side of the road and having the steering wheel on a different side of the car. It was a rocky 48 hours, guys. It was rocky. It was, I feared for my safety. My wife, was basically, had her eyes closed the entire time. But I think once we got past that little speed bump, if you will, or pedestrian, I don't know. I'm good now. I've mastered it. You wouldn't even know I was a tourist.
Dude, I feel like that would break my brain. I don't even know if I would ever be capable of driving on the wrong side of the road. That just sounds like, it sounds like I would just be like, okay, all right, sounds good. And then I would just instantly get in a wreck.
I'll tell you, the wrong side of the road is in my opinion, about 20% of the battle. Because the rest of the battle is the fucking steering wheel placement. Like, it is really so weird. Everything is the other side. And I'll tell you this, I almost rented a stick shift because stick shifts are really big in Europe. And I love driving stick shifts. So I almost got a manual. I am so glad I didn't because I cannot tell you. I don't think I'm capable of driving a manual with my left hand. I do not think it's possible because the shifter would be on the left side.
I couldn't even imagine.
Yeah, I don't. So I'm really glad I didn't do that. But I have mastered it. The good news for anyone who's listening and you're debating on going to Ireland and maybe you're nervous about driving in the UK in general, I cannot speak for Scotland or England, but I can tell you in Ireland, they drive like fucking psychos. So you will be just fine. They drive insane.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, dude.
I didn't know the Irish had a penchant for bad driving.
Yeah, dude. I'm not trying to stereotype or anything. This is just something I've witnessed for the last going on 2 weeks. People drive insane. Pedestrians do whatever the fuck they want. Sometimes they'll wait. Sometimes they won't. It gets crazy downtown. Like so. It was really helpful for me because everybody else is driving poorly. Also, the roads are kind of poorly marked at some spots and they're super narrow, which all this shit is on. If you Google any list about, hey, how to get ready for Ireland, first thing it's going to be in the top five, narrow roads. you're going to think, hey, I'm not going to fit there. And then you do. So it's fine.
Well, and also, I mean, you're driving an F-150 King cab, so that's,
well,
you know, that's going to make things more difficult.
It's funny you say that because I rented a small car. I rented a car, like a little four-door Hyundai, just to shoot around. Like you know, this should be simple. I want a small, cheap car. That's how I like to rent cars when I travel. I get there and they're like, "Hey, good news, for you. You get a free upgrade because we're out of that car." And I'm like, okay, what's the upgrade? And they were like, oh, just like a bigger size, like a Camry. So I'm like, okay, I can deal with a Camry. So then he goes to book it and he's like, oh, somebody just took it. So better news, you get a bigger upgrade. And I'm like, great, what's the bigger upgrade? And he's like, well, in America, this is probably considered a small SUV, but in Ireland, it's a large SUV. So Jesus. So I left with an SUV, and that's also been interesting because it's so fucking big.
Right.
But either way.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
So you are driving around in a big ass American car.
Yeah. It's just one of these big ass four door, it's a European car. So it's that they don't have it in the States, but it's like the size of like a Subaru Outback. Like it's a decent size SUV, and it has not been fun. I mean, it's fine now because I learned how to deal with it, but it has not been fun. It was not fun for the first couple of days. So also getting off the plane after a red eye flight and being totally just out of it. I'm like stumbling through the airport, and then I just get in the car, and I honestly don't even remember how we made it to our Airbnb, but we got there. So.
Oh boy. And not only that, from what I understand, the SUV runs on potatoes. Is that right?
Hey, you know what? I'm not going to indulge in these racist stereotypes of the Irish.
Wait, I can say it though. I'm Irish. So
That is true. You are one of those potato eating sons of bitches. So
Right. Keep your voice down.
Anyway,
actually, yeah. No, you're in Belfast. Yeah, we should just lift the curtain. You're in Belfast. So like is there anybody who hates Irish people more than the Northern Irish? They hate Ireland so much. They just want to be England, basically.
Dude, it's really funny. Like guys, bear with us. Obviously we know we're a movie podcast, but this is very interesting kind of stuff for those of you who are at least a little bit interested in Ireland. So we're driving to Belfast and we're driving up from Dublin. It's like a 2-hour drive. So clearly, just like the rest of Europe, it's metric. So you're looking at kilometers, you're looking at meters, you're looking at Celsius, all this shit. So I don't know why. I need to look it up. I'm very curious. But the only thing that Northern Ireland changed is miles instead of kilometers. So we're driving and it's like, oh, 50 kilometers. And then we get to a certain point and it's like, oh, Northern Ireland. And it immediately changes to miles. But literally nothing else changes. They still use meters. Really? They use grams for like weighing food or any of that. The two biggest differences from the rest of Ireland to Northern Ireland is they use miles instead, and they do not use euros. They use pounds. So I can use euros everywhere else in Ireland, but as soon as we got to Northern Ireland, I had to get out some cash that's pounds because that's what they use here, which I find to be really interesting.
That's crazy. I just looked it up. Yeah, that's the way that they do miles in the UK.
It's just really like bizarre.
Just about everything else is metric. That's insane.
Yeah, dude, it was such a weird kind of change after dealing with kilometers for over a week in Dublin.
Well, you know what? Just more evidence that the United Kingdom is a cultural bankrupt nation that shouldn't exist by any humane standard.
Well, you know, it's funny you say that too, because I do have something to ask our UK listeners. Listen, guys, I've traveled, you know, Iceland is considered Europe, which is weird to me, but it is. So I have now been to two different places in Europe, and two different places have the same shitty appliance. And I would like to address something with our UK listeners. Am I just having bad luck? Or do your washer and dryers, those combined machines that you guys use over here, that literally holds like three shirts and two pairs of socks, do they suck? Do they suck on a universal scale? Or have I just have bad luck at literally seven Airbnbs of just having the worst fucking washer dryer combo known to man? Because they are terrible. Like everything about most of the appliances. Like
it's a European problem.
See, that's what I need to know. So like any of our UK listeners, we know we got a lot in England. You guys, is this a problem? Is it a well-known problem? Is it just me? I really need to know because it's driving me insane. I have had to Google about more manuals for random brands of washer dryer combos that I've been traveling. I know more about European machines than I do about American machines at this point. like the other night, I'm just fucking Googling what this error code means. So yeah, that's it. So I don't understand it.
I mean, Europe has, you know, the livable cities, and they have, you know, the universal healthcare and free college and all that other shit, and, you know, cultural heritage and things like that. But in America, we make up for all that by having treats. And I don't mean treats, you know, treats are obviously food, but also just little convenience treats, you know, like little like washers that are the size of a Volkswagen Bug, you know, that never break down, you know, that I think we've got Maytag washing machines that have been, you know, operating since the Nixon administration. Right. Like we're better at making stuff, I think, than Europe. Whereas, you know, they have all the things that nourish the soul, whereas we have things that nourish the, you know, the day-to-day life.
Well, I Googled because I am irresponsible in some ways, but in other ways I'm very responsible. One of those ways is knowing what to do in case of an emergency. I Googled, like, what do I do if I have an emergency in another country, like in terms of their healthcare? Because, like, clearly, like, I'm sure there's a big thing with, like, people coming to countries with free medicine, like, you know, free healthcare, and, like, maybe taking advantage of it. I don't know how all that works, but I knew there was a system. And apparently, if something happens and there's an emergency, like, if it's a life-threatening emergency, like, I'm bleeding or something, then you call their emergency line, which I think is, like, 112. But if it's not, and it's just like, oh, I've got the flu and I need to go get some medicine or this or that, you have to contact the U.S. Embassy or the U.S. Consulate, and they will tell you where you can go as an American to get treated, which I think is hilarious.
Oh, my God.
Now, that's just what I read on Google. I have not had to do it and put it to the test, so I don't know how accurate that is, but that is what Google told me.
What a broken country. We can't even go to another country to get, like, some aspirin or something. It's like, no. We'll tell you where your insurance is covered. Like... overseas, like, you better not take advantage of it.
Yeah, it's really bizarre. I don't begin to understand the ins and outs of it, but you know, hopefully no emergencies will happen, so I won't get to put that to the test. But yeah,
fingers crossed.
Anyway, so yeah, I'm in Ireland. I'm sitting, it's rainy and 30 degrees outside. But my original question, I'm still very curious, has New York gotten shitty weather yet? Or, cause I was in Boston. I passed through Boston on the way to Ireland, and it was fucking 68 degrees outside and sunny. And that was November 3rd or some shit.
No, it's been cold here. It's been cold here, but it hasn't snowed yet, and it hasn't been raining because, in Western New York, there was an insane blizzard. They had to cancel an NFL game. I guess they didn't cancel it. They moved it from Buffalo to Detroit. But yeah, no, it's just been fine and cold here. That's really it. Yeah. Okay. Next time you ask me this, I'll be prepared. I'll ask somebody who actually leaves their apartment. and see what they have to say.
All you have to do is open a window and put your hand out it and just see That's what's true. Happening.
Just stick my hand out. Yeah. Okay. Next time I'll do that.
So, hey, finally, some movie discussion, guys. Guess what I get to go see in theaters, because I think it's only going to be in theaters for 1 week before it hits Netflix or something. But I'm going to see the Knives Out sequel tomorrow.
Ugh.
What do you mean, ugh? You like the first Knives Out.
It's fine, but ugh.
Well, you're a rational hatred of Ryan, what's his name, Johnson? Ryan Johnson. No,
it's not irrational.
Well, either way, I have not seen a trailer for this movie at all, but I did enjoy Knives Out. Obviously, the heavy-handed message was kind of whatever, but the characters were fun. I thought it was a funny movie. I thought Daniel Craig did a great job. So I'm going into this one blind. I have no idea what the story is. I don't know anything about it. But I do have to say I am a big fan of Agatha Christie's series, like the Hercule Poirot guy. I'm a big fan of that. So I think having this central detective, like, I think it's always fun to have like something that is actually a whodunit with a detective that doesn't involve Sherlock Holmes. So I think it's really like, for me, this is kind of a genre that I like. They just don't do very well all the time. So I'm looking forward to seeing it.
I will say this, you know, obviously my distaste for Mr. Johnson's films, I have post Brick, I should say. Gotta show some love to Brick. Great movie. What was I gonna say? Oh yeah. One thing I will say positive about the Knives Out and the fact that it's becoming this big Netflix monstrosity is that you're right. The mystery, you know, the Agatha Christie style mystery of, you know, of whodunit, basically. And that's the general mover of the plot, as opposed to like a conventional thriller. You know, that genre would be yet another genre that we talk about dying. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
Or dead, basically. Like, it would be another one of those genres to be like, well, they don't make those anymore, obviously, because they don't make, you know, they don't make a lot of genre movies anymore. But, you know, we do have Knives Out. And so that's, I think he's single-handedly, you know, kind of rescuing that genre from the bargain bin. So, you know, shout out to him. And I did enjoy the movie. I just can't stand the, I mean, Jesus Christ, Netflix paid like $1 billion for like the rights to the next sequels. I mean, look, whatever. You knock yourself out. Everybody enjoy Knives Out. I may or may not watch it. I don't know. Actually, I probably won't. I don't have a Netflix subscription, so I probably won't.
Well, I'm pretty sure Daniel Craig made like $100 million for the two sequels. He got paid like $50 million for each movie.
Hey,
which is insane. If you get it. Hell yeah. Because I like Daniel Craig. I think that dude's funny. Anyway.
Daniel Craig's got to be, I mean, dude, with the Bond movies, I mean, he's got to be just absolutely stacked with cash now. I mean,
I don't know if this
is not a billionaire yet.
I don't know if this is true, but I heard that that Daniel Craig made like, I think like upwards when it was all said and done, like $80 million for the last Bond movie or some shit, which is nuts.
Jesus.
That's like Robert Downey Jr. money, but I'm not, don't quote me on that. I'm not sure if that's true. I just heard it and I don't care enough to verify it. So,
They say his net worth is only, and of course this is internet, so it's probably just fucking made up, but they say it's 160 million. That seems low.
Yeah, that does seem low. Cause like I said, it was a pretty well-known thing when Netflix bought Knives Out that he got like the biggest salary. So
yeah, it says he made $85 million from being James Bond total.
Yeah, that's crazy. Like, maybe, who knows? Maybe I was wrong. I don't watch James Bond movies, so I don't even know how good he is in them. But
oh, he's great, dude. You've never seen any of the Craig James Bonds?
No, I watched Casino Royale, and that was really fun. That's about it.
Casino Royale is good, and Skyfall is good, but I actually haven't seen the last two.
I need to watch Skyfall because I'm a big Sam Mendes fan. So,
dude, Skyfall is sick, man, and also one of the best. one of the most beautiful, our boy Deakins, Roger Deakins, one of the best, Roger Deakins, cinematography moments, I think.
Yeah, I know, which is why I need to watch it, because you've got Deakins and Mendes and a great review. So yeah, I need to check it out. But
because Deakins does, like, that's my favorite Deakins, is him elevating an otherwise like fine, like, you know, B type picture into like looking amazing, you know.
Hey, there's layers to James Bond, okay, buddy? It's a very deep, artful type of franchise.
When Sean Connery slaps a woman and tells her to shut her mouth, it's real. There's a lot of layers there.
Yeah, when she's like no, and he's like yes.
Like, so no means yes, right? Yeah, that's, it's complicated.
Listen, I went and saw a movie. It was raining the other night, and we didn't know what to do, so it's like, fuck it, we'll go to a movie downtown Dublin. We went and saw The Menu, and I got to tell you, it was really fun. It was fucking insane.
Wait, what is this? What is The Menu? I don't know what this is.
So it's a Ralph Fiennes-led movie with Anya Taylor-Joy, and I don't know what to tell you what it's about. I really can't. I really don't know how. It is. I saw one trailer for it. I didn't want to know anything about it. I knew I wanted to see it because it was very intriguing. I like movies about intense chefs, intense like to good. Somebody on Twitter put it this way, and I think this is a very he didn't mean any offense by it, so I don't mean any offense by it by using it. He said The Menu is like a stupid version of Pig. Like there's no like artful soul there. And I know me and you disagree on Pig. I do think Pig was a pretty deep, like heartfelt movie about grief and passion and all that. This is the opposite. This is like, no, the message is clear from the beginning. I don't give a shit about elevating it. I don't give a shit about making it sound smarter, because actually it's pretty stupid and really petty, but it doesn't matter because I'm going to do whatever the fuck I want. And that's exactly what the movie is. Like it is. So
this sounds like it's the movie that I wanted Pig to be.
I mean, maybe don't get me wrong. I'm not telling you this movie is like Pig. I'm just saying in concept, like Pig tried and I do think they accomplished it. They tried to go high concept, like with the thoughtful process they put into the movie and Nick Cage's performance. This movie is not a high concept, and it's so much fun, and it's so cynical, and it's so hateful, and I love it so much. It was insane, honestly. I walked out of the movie theater and I was like, that was amazing, but I don't know what it was trying to say. And then after a day of thinking about it, I was like, you don't have to figure out what it was trying to say, because it wasn't trying to tell you anything. It was just very hateful, very cynical. It was very funny.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah, I don't know. I think you should watch it if it comes out and hits Hulu or one of those services you have, or HBO Max or something. I think it's worth watching. It was, dude, Ralph Fiennes. I'm sorry. Ralph Fiennes is such an underrated treasure. Like, I mean, just his performance in In Bruges alone ranks as one of my favorite performances in the last 20 years, like from a character actor like him. So the dude has, like, they wrote that part for Ralph Fiennes, and they said they did not have a backup plan if he said no. So Ralph Fiennes was on board, and they said the performance he turned in was better than what they had written, like better than what they had hoped. So he was really, really good in the movie.
Damn, okay. All right.
But yeah, for anyone that wants to see it and you're on the fence about it, go see it. It's a lot of fun, but it is not like the movie is not trying to be something it's not. It's very aware of what it is. It's not pretentious. It's not it's not trying to be like A24 or highbrow. It's just like, no, this is what it is. Like, and I really don't want to say how they did that so well, because it gives away a lot of the movie. It gives away a lot of the plot to say why they did it so well.
Okay. Oh yeah, I'll watch a trailer for it. I'd never even heard of it.
And hey, good news for you and our listeners who have not seen this yet. Banshees of Inisherin will be hitting HBO Max December 13th, I believe.
Okay.
So,
okay.
Yeah, I'm going to go see that again while we're in Ireland because I feel like it's fitting to go see the Banshees of Inisherin while in Ireland.
Oh, so, yeah. It'll be a whole different experience.
Yeah, so nothing like feeling like I've been punched in the stomach and the face at the same time. So, of course, I want to go see it again. Because it managed to be really funny and like genuinely make me laugh because Martin McDonagh is fantastic at kind of doing the dark with like a very Coen Brothers type of feel. But then it also manages to be probably the bleakest movie I've seen this year and might be one of the bleakest I've seen in a while. So, and by the way, speaking of which, I've been paying attention on Twitter. You motherfuckers need to let the Three Billboards thing go. It's a bad movie. We get it. Like, we talked about it on this podcast before. McDonagh tried to make a movie about two things he didn't understand, the South and racism, and it failed miserably. But he's still a fantastic director. So I don't understand why the whole Three Billboards thing is still like a narrative.
Yeah, I actually disagree with this. I think this is a topic that I was going to bring up. You're not going to like it.
Oh, but, here we go. Go ahead.
Yeah, but like, I think there's some one hit, like, I don't want to say one hit wonders, but there's some directors whose previous work is really carrying a lot of water for them and they need to be taken down a peg. You know, Rian Johnson is obviously a great example in my opinion. But I also think, Martin McDonagh is also one.
He's made one questionable movie, one question out of four. He's made one movie that's like, nah, that was a miss. And even then, there were certain positive elements in it.
I disagree, actually. I don't think there were any positive elements. I think he's a good writer, but I don't think he's a good director. Not everyone has to make movies. And Seven Psychopaths is good. I remember I watched it because you said you liked it a lot. It's good, but it's fine. I think he's been coasting on In Bruges up until now. Obviously, I haven't seen the latest movie, but, you know, he comes to mind. And another one who obviously comes to mind is Del Toro. Del Toro's coasting, man. He's been coasting on, you know, that original trilogy of Devil's Backbone and Pan's Labyrinth and the other one that I can't think of. And, dude, I don't know what he's doing. Did you see his screen test for At the Mountains of Madness?
No, I have not had a chance to look at it. But I will say, I'm going to hard disagree with you. Shape of Water wasn't the best, but there were still beautiful elements in that movie, and it was a beautiful movie. It was very well directed, and I was a huge fan, and I wasn't the only one. There was a lot of people that were a huge fan of Nightmare Alley and thought it was beautiful and well directed. So I'm gonna give you a little bit of pushback on Del Toro. I won't argue about McDonagh. Like, it is what it is. Del Toro, on the other hand, I'm sorry, dude. In terms of what that guy does off the camera as well, and Pinocchio looks like it's going to be next level stop motion, like so handcrafted and beautifully directed. I mean, I could be wrong. I'm going to watch it. I'm excited. I'm gonna argue with you on Del Toro a bit. I won't bother with Johnson or McDonagh. McDonagh's like, it is what it is. Like, people don't want to like him, whatever. I do think he's a great director. And Banshees is probably the best movie of the year, if I'm being honest. So,
yeah, I mean, I don't know. And I know we obviously would disagree about Del Toro, but I don't know, man. That Shape of Water, I think it's fine. I remember liking it when it came out.
See, you defended Nightmare Shape Out. Of Water. You defended Shape of Water against me because I said I wasn't the biggest fan of it.
I think it's good. I think it's a good movie. It's fine. But I'm talking about his elevation as like some auteur or whatever. I mean, like, when you look at Kronos, Devil's Backbone, and Pan's Labyrinth, you cannot tell me that he lived up to the hype as a filmmaker. Like, especially after Pan's Labyrinth. Like, it has to be seen as a... His career has to be seen as a disappointment after Pan's Labyrinth. I mean, I mean, come on. Like, it's, you know, like, it's not even, I mean, Crimson Peak, Pacific Rim, Nightmare Alley is fine. I know you liked it better than I did. Shape of Water, I think, is pretty good. But, like, you know, and the Hellboy movies are fine. They're good. But, like, it's one of those things where it's like, oh, we thought this guy was going to be something different. And it turns out he's just a fine director. He's okay, you know.
See, but that's where I disagree with you, because I don't think it's not about, oh, he's a fine director or whatever. It's about the vision. I think Del Toro is one of the most visionary directors we have working today in terms of what he sees and what he can put on camera. The Hellboy movies, as weird as it is to say this about a pretty, you know, comic book type movie, they're beautiful. There were a lot of practical effects, a lot of real makeup, something that we barely get from any comic book movies being made now. Crimson Peak, I wasn't a big fan of, but it was beautiful. Amazing sets, amazing house that he put together. Like, the dude is a visionary. So that's where I think, that's why I give you pushback on Del Toro. Because, yeah, did Del Toro live up to Pan's Labyrinth? Probably not, because Pan's Labyrinth is like a perfect movie. I mean, it's an amazing feat of storytelling, and it's beautifully directed. And I really don't know if it has a flaw. To me, I just really love it. But I do think that he is a visionary, dude. I think that that's what sets him apart from these other directors. Because honestly, we haven't talked about this at all, off pod, on pod, or whatever, but I've been thinking the same thing, but I've been doing it with actors and actresses in terms of people who aren't as good as we thought they were, or they're not as good currently as a lot of people think they are. So it's interesting you brought up directors, because I think that's also a fun conversation. I've got to give you pushback on Del Toro, man, because the guy, you can say you didn't like Nightmare Alley, and that's fine, and Shape of Water was fine or whatever, but the dude is a visionary, man. Like, in the same level of his name escapes me, the director of Parasite. Bong Joon-ho. In terms of like storyboarding and like the shit that they have in their head that they can perfectly put on camera, good or bad, I really appreciate that level of vision. And I know that maybe doesn't appeal to some people, and that's fine, but that's where I land with Del Toro.
Yeah, it just seems hollow to me. I mean, yeah, sure, Nightmare Alley is great looking, and Shape of Water is great looking. I mean, to the extent that it's a different kind of eye candy than, well, I was going to say different kind of eye candy, but we don't really get eye candy in movies anymore. So that's not the right thing to say. But like, yeah, there's a certain eye candy element to it. But I mean, you know, that's like, I mean, is that even half of directing? Is it a quarter? You know, like I don't know. These movies feel soulless to me, and I just think it's time, folks. It's time. Like, I don't know. Yeah, we're not gonna see eye to eye on this, but
not at all.
The Pinocchio. I watched the trailer for the Pinocchio thing, and I'm like, okay, it's another great looking movie. Like, is this thing gonna move me? Am I ever gonna feel the same level of like haunted? You know, haunted and sad and complex, you know, are we ever going to get the same horror and terror feeling that we get in Pan's Labyrinth? Are we ever going to get that again from Del Toro? I don't think we are. And I don't think we have.
I think the biggest problem here that we're running into is you're basically a soulless cretin, and you can't, you can't just be like, okay, yeah, like Del Toro does have some misses to me, but like he still has soulful and beauty, his soul and beauty in what he's doing. It's like, I can't allow that. I'm sorry. You know, whatever. You ruin this whole episode by what do you call it? You sneak attacked me. Like, I'm talking about Martin McDonagh and how Banshees of Inisherin is probably the best movie of the year to me. And then you're like, hey, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to slam him and Del Toro. I don't give a shit what you do to Ryan Johnson. So, okay, all right. Whatever.
We'll move on.
I'm sitting in Ireland. I'm just basking and the joys of what the UK and this beautiful country has to offer. I'm gonna go see Banshees of Inisherin and watch it in Ireland, and then I'm just gonna have this little discussion in the back of my head saying, Del Toro sucks. McDonagh's a sucky director.
Look, man. Oh man, you know what? What can I say? I'm just a spoil sport. That's what I am.
You know, and also I will tell you this. Normally I would say maybe I'm being a bit biased because I do love Del Toro, like personally. Like I've read anything he puts out, anything he does, I read it. I absorb it.
See, I think that's doing a lot of that is what's keeping him afloat, is the fact that like he's very smart and he knows a lot about movies, and like his off-screen, you know, like he's a nice guy, he's charming, and he knows a lot about movies and stuff. I think that's keeping him afloat, you know?
Yeah, I mean, hey, possibly, dude. I just appreciate it. I just appreciate him because I do think he's a visionary. I do think he does things that nobody else is doing, or very few people are doing right now in terms of what he wants to do. And there are certain aspects of what he's doing I really appreciate. So, am I too close, or am I biased, and maybe I'm not seeing the full picture? Possibly. I'm not gonna say I'm not, but I do truly
Yeah,
think
let's go with
I do truly think that
No. Let's go with that. You don't have to get.
he's one of the most creative people left in Hollywood, and frankly, the fact that you don't see that makes me want to I don't know.
Okay, so he's one of the most creative people in Hollywood. Yeah, well, I'm wearing the most clothes at the nudist colony, you know? Like.
I'm glad that you jumped in there because I was trying to think of something that I wouldn't have to edit out. And then I couldn't. So anyway, look, I do think what you brought up is a bigger discussion. I think that we could have it on a larger scale in terms of jumping into some of that, because I do think I think it's interesting to kind of examine what is going on, especially it's kind of in the zeitgeist or whatever the fucking word is. With Tarantino talking about how he believes this is the worst era of movies we've seen since the 50s and the 80s. So I do think that's an interesting thing to talk about. I'm not prepared for it. And honestly, I'm what's the word? Angry that you bashed Del Toro.
Oh man. All right. Well, you know, moving on.
It is interesting. No, like I said, seriously, it is interesting you were thinking about that with directors, because I've been doing the same thing. I've been reevaluating not just how I feel, but how a lot of Hollywood feels and how people feel in general about certain actors and actresses. And I think it's really interesting.
Like what actors you want to get into? You want to save it for another day?
I want to save it for another day because there's a lot there, and I'm very curious to see what your thoughts are.
All right.
And we're already about 40 minutes in, so I want to talk about this movie, and then we'll save that fodder for another time.
All right.
This movie is one you picked because I was like, hey man, let's try to record an episode, and when I'm in Ireland, that'll be cool. So you found one that not only is it I it's in Ireland, it's in fucking Belfast. It's called Odd Man Out. It's a Carol Reed classic that I've learned from researching it from 1947. It's based on a book. It's got a James Mason, Robert Newton, and it's basically a wounded Irish nationalist leader attempts to evade the police following a failed robbery in Belfast. And that's essentially the movie. It's like a British noir kind of thing. And the movie is literally this guy getting in this trouble in the beginning, and kind of the rest of the movie is just him getting worse for an hour and 50 minutes. And I have something really funny that I laughed my ass off when I heard it. So I'm not taking credit for this. I was listening to some guys talk about noirs and talk about just different ones. And he was like, well, Odd Man Out counts as a noir, like that they classify it as a noir. And he's like, how do you feel about that? Because the guy he was talking to, I can't remember his name, but he's a noir expert. He was like, yeah, I go to Noir Con like every year. And he's like, a few years ago, I heard a guy say this about noirs. And I think that we really kind of get lost in the weeds with what is noir. And this is timely because me and you talked about this when we did Sweet Smell of Success last week. And he said, look, the guy put it very bluntly. A noir is you're fucked in the beginning, and by the end, you're even more fucked. And I was like, that's pretty blunt, but it's also really funny and somewhat true because like then I started rattling through noirs in my head, and I was like, that's how every noir went. Like, it doesn't matter if there's a detective or a femme fatale or anything. Typically the character is in worse shape or dead by the end of a movie than they were at the beginning.
Yeah, no, I think yeah, I'm pretty elastic with my definition of noirs, you know? I mean, they usually it's just like a movie where a bunch of bad shit happens and there's crime involved, and you know what I mean?
Yeah,
Yeah.
I just I'm a
So
little bit of a stickler when it comes to those really broad definitions, but you know what? It is what it is. It's a battle I'll never win. So, anyway, Odd Man Out. That this movie was I mean, first and foremost, it was fucking beautiful. Like it was a really beautifully shot movie. Carol Reed, clearly the great director, The Third Man, probably his biggest movie. Anyway, what did you think about Odd Man Out? Just give us your quick thoughts and kind of a rundown. Were you had this your first time watching it? Was it a rewatch? Like,
no, this is a rewatch for me. You know, something I've been trying to do is kind of catalog the noirs in my mind because I've seen so many of them, and like it's like, you know, watching them again, because like I've seen so many noirs that like in the early days of streaming, you know, Netflix would have like a bunch of just random stuff, and I'd be like, oh, all these are streaming, I'll just like watch all of these noirs, or they'll be on Amazon Prime or whatever. And then I would go back and like I would look up like noirs to watch, you know, and then I'd be like, have I seen this one? You know, because I mean, obviously they all have very similar plots and very similar plot elements. So, you know, you could be, which didn't necessarily happen with Odd Man Out, but it fits into kind of my larger project of going back and watching some of these noirs that I'd seen years ago and kind of categorizing them in my mind, right? Because I remember I saw, you know, In a Lonely Place for like the second time, and I was like, oh my God, this is like the best one. You know, this is like my favorite noir, you know? And like, other ones don't hold up quite as well. You know, Asphalt Jungle like is good. It's a good movie. I like it, but it's not on the upper echelon for me, you know, even though it might be for many other people. That is the case with this movie. I was like rewatching it and I was like, I'm like, how do I categorize this? Is this one of my favorite noirs or is this just a really good one? And I think it turned out to just be a really good one. I just don't think, yeah, this is gonna be this is gonna be a little xenophobic of me, but a noir that doesn't take place in America, you know, it's never gonna be at the top of my list, you know. But I do, obviously, I do appreciate you know, some of these British noirs, and in this case an Irish noir. You know, I think the reason you know buy a ticket to this movie is Carol Reed working with the cinematographer Robert Krasker. They work together on The Third Man, which is, you know, probably, you know, one of the central just visual consolidations of everything that film noir was up until that time, and all the visual tricks and all the, you know, whatever, are kind of consolidated into that movie. And there's a weird spirit of Orson Welles that even nudges that movie a little further into expressionist territory. But you know, you can see the beauty, and you can see the, I don't even want to say you can see the formulation. You can just see the beauty of it. You can just see the same, incredible visual look in The Third Man. You can see that in Odd Man Out. The visual palette is very, very similar. And obviously it's, you know, they're different movies. One is in Vienna, you know, one is in, you know, Belfast, and so on and so forth. But, it's the visuals are very, very similar, and therefore the visuals are very, very just stunning and beautiful. And it's almost kind of a portrait of guilt, or it's kind of like a psychological noir. You know what it reminded me of? It reminded me of what's the name of that Sam Fuller movie that's in that Eclipse set?
There's
the Man Who Killed Jesse James.
Yeah, that's a good one. That's a good comparison.
Yeah, it reminded me of that because it really is kind of about one man's kind of one long dark night of the, you know, of the imagination. You know what I mean? Like, what's his name? James Mason's performance is really incredible. I mean, obviously, because the camera's focused on him 90% of the time, and his performance is really, really stunning as he portrays this kind of just man in torment, I guess I would say. I don't know. What about you? What did you think about it? And did you feel like you were in the movie as you're wandering around the streets of Belfast in the middle of the night?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I text you as I was walking around the rainy streets of Belfast, like 9 o'clock by myself. And I had just watched Odd Man Out and I really loved it. Like I'm walking past, like there's a night sky, there's some street lights, you know, and I'm walking past these beautiful old churches and these big Gothic style, like peaks on them and shit. And it's just, it was so fucking cool. Just like having just watched this movie, which I don't even know how much of it was filmed in Belfast, to be honest with you. I know a lot of it was filmed in England, I believe. But either way, it was just, you still got the same vibe from it. So that was really fucking cool. But in terms of,
I'm pretty sure it's filmed in Belfast.
Oh, it was? I thought that I read that it was filmed in, a lot of it was filmed in England. Either way,
I don't know.
Well, I could be wrong. I'm going to look it up because I thought I read that. Yeah, much of the film being shot in the city. It looks like it is not known. Like apparently this headline says, Odd Man Out makers get thumbs down over Belfast locations. I don't know what that means. I don't know. So either way, you get the vibe. That's all that matters. You get the vibe. I'll tell you, I liked this movie. Like I said, I thought it was beautiful. A lot of shadows, a lot of things in the street. I love that shit that just kind of puts you in it. But it was like that's why I really liked your comparison to the Man Who Shot Jesse James, because it was a very contemplative movie. Like it was very, it was very moody. It wasn't like, you know, a couple weeks ago we did Night of the Hunter and Out of the Past, and both of those movies are like boot on your throat, let's fucking go, like hour and a half, hour and 40 minutes of like let's get to it. And even Sweet Smell of Success, that I wasn't a big fan of, for anybody that listened last week, upon my rewatch, it was still very snappy. It was very fast. It was very like, you had Lancaster here and you had Curtis here, and there's always something going on or somebody trying to get one over on somebody else. But with this, while they did spend obviously most of the movie looking for Johnny, you still had like, it was a very slow movie. It was very like, oh, you're wounded. Oh, that wound's pretty bad. Oh, I need to talk to a priest. At least I can get a confession in. Oh, the cops are coming. You got to move me. And nobody wanted to commit. And this, like, it was a very, like, it seemed like they toned it down to make it more contemplative on this man's journey when they could have made it really fast paced. Hey, the cops are on your tail. Hey, we got to get you out of here. And really, like, kind of made it feel more claustrophobic. And I have to imagine that was on purpose.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's definitely, you know, and that's why the comparison to The Third Man is really interesting, because I mean, you know, I don't want Orson Welles to take over this conversation the way that he did The Third Man, but like Orson Welles kind of shadow directed The Third Man in a way. And like, if you watch the rest of Carol Reed's movies, none of them have the the pace, the kind of breathless pace of The Third Man, which has the same breathless pace of, for example, an Orson Welles movie. And so there's a little like, huh, what was, you know, was Carol Reed taking suggestions from Orson Welles when he was editing this movie together or whatever? Because Odd Man Out is almost completely the opposite, right? And even in The Third Man, there's that lively score, you know, that famous score in The Third Man. Odd Man Out is very, yeah, like you said, it's the dark winter of the soul, you know, just wandering through Belfast, you know, being chased from the cops. It's, yeah, it's very slow and contemplative, and yeah, I don't know. It's definitely a different vibe. I mean, I like noirs like this. You know, another noir that this made me think of is, well, there's a few actually that just came to mind when I thought of that. Killer's Kiss, Stanley Kubrick's first movie, is basically just footage of like 50s era New York, you know. And then The Wrong Man, the Alfred Hitchcock movie, The Wrong Man, is another great example of a very slow kind of contemplative noir. And there are some early kind of proto noirs like this. One of them is I Wake Up Screaming, The Stranger on the Third Floor, where, and even in movies like Vertigo, you get, I mean, Vertigo is doing a bit almost about the classic noir, but, and even in Maltese Falcon, you get a lot of different passages of the detective just following somebody, right? Obviously, in this case, there's, you know, we're not the detective, we're just the camera that's following people. But that is, and you look at Blade Runner, there's a huge part in the middle of the original Blade Runner that is just Harrison Ford just fucking following people around the amazing world of Blade Runner. And I think you're right to draw that comparison, this, especially compared to the ones that we've been watching. You know, it's like there's a primary motivator or primary attraction to these noirs. You know, in Out of the Past, it's clearly Mitchum. You know, in Sweet Smell of Success, it's that pace, that dialogue, you know. And Night of the Hunter, it's, you know, it's clearly everything. But you're right, it's that boot on your neck and it pedal to the metal. Whereas, like, yeah, Odd Man Out is more, it's slower, it's vibes, it's snowfall, you know, as opposed to a lightning strike. Yeah, that's interesting. Well, it'd be interesting to think about other movies, other noirs like this that are more slower, I guess.
Well, I can tell you, the bar was set at Crown Bar in Belfast, but it was basically a studio that they built in Denham, Buckinghamshire, and was not filmed at the Royal Crown. But much of the film was shot on location. Exterior scenes were shot in West Belfast, although some were shot at the Broadway Market in London. So that's really interesting.
Kind of all over the place.
Yeah, because I was in West Belfast earlier today, but I'm staying in East Belfast, and that's what I've seen mainly. But either way, I mean, dude, there was something surreal about watching a movie like this. That's not like, yeah, you know, I've watched a lot of movies that were shot in Texas, and I've spent a lot of time in Texas, and I watched a lot of movies that were shot in Florida or Alabama. And yeah, you see the landscape, and yeah, I get it. Like, it looks like the fucking state. But here, like, experiencing this in a different country, and not just any country, but a country with such an interesting past, especially in Northern Ireland, with all the strife and civil wars that have taken place, there was something just next level awesome about it. And I'm so glad you picked this movie. So glad I was able to watch it. You know, like I said, it was my first time. I really, really enjoyed it. I think it was a very beautiful film. But like I said, it was a very slow paced noir in terms of other ones we've talked about. So that is something to know. For those of you who have not seen this movie before, go into it. It's great. You'll like it, but it is a slow paced noir than maybe your typical noir you're used to with with a lead criminal or lead detective in a film fatale kind of thing. So.
Yeah, you bring up a really interesting point, which is, leaving, maybe not necessarily leaving the theater, but watching a movie and being in the world of the movie, feeling like you go for a walk and you're in that environment, And I'm interested, do you have any other experiences that come to mind? Because all mine, I can't really think. Spring Breakers definitely feels like Florida. Magic Mike definitely feels like Florida. I remember watching those in a theater in Florida and be like, oh, that's right here. That's right here. But obviously my primary ones are New York. I remember I watched Uncut Gems like a few blocks away from the Diamond District. Just any movie set in New York that I watch, The Apartment, which I rewatched recently. It's like, oh yeah, that's right outside. Rear Window is another one. So like, I feel like all of mine are New York centric. But you've lived a few different places than me. Do you have any other experiences like that that stand out?
I'll tell you the top two that come to mind, hell or high water. I've spent a lot of time in Texas, have family in Texas, stayed in Texas a lot. That is a brutally realistic small town Texas feel. It's as realistic as you can get.
Interesting.
That
Okay.
one hit. And then Winter's Bone, which basically it's a meth riddled winter Kansas countryside. But I feel like once you experience that type of drug-ridden community in a small town where it's very bleak and cold and brutal winters, I think that can apply to a lot of the South. It can apply to a lot of places. I've been in Georgia and a lot of places I've been in Alabama as well. Those are the two
Interesting.
that come to
Okay.
mind.
Okay. Yeah, it's always something fun to think about of like oh yeah, I can watch this movie and then I can go outside or and feel like I'm walking around it, or drive 10 miles and feel like I'm walking around it, Yeah, interesting.
Well, anyway, guys, that's Odd Man Out. It's a great noir as we continue our Noirvember vibe here at the Silver Screen. Go check it out. It's on HBO Max. It's on Criterion. You can watch it. I'm sure you can rent it somewhere as well. But if you've never seen it, check it out. Let us know what you think. Aside from that, I am going to get back to enjoying not being in America. And enjoy the beautiful countryside of the potato land that is Ireland. Jacob, do you have
Enjoy
anything
the
to
beautiful potatoes and the brown liquor of the Irish.
add? Do you have anything to add before we get out of here?
Nah, man, let's wrap it up.
Guys, rate and review wherever you listen. And once again, apologize if the sound's a little weird. Like I said, a different microphone, and apologize as well. This episode's come out a little late. But we really wanted to do a recording while I was in Ireland to kind of give us a kind of a different feel about things. So, yeah, either way, hope you enjoyed this, and we'll see you next week at the Silver Screen Video.